Fan Morning Show, Sports at 5-9 of the Fan. I'm J.D. Bunkus, Blake Murphy, Justin Cufford with us. It was revealed to us that Justin's dad, Chris, actually listened to our show yesterday, listened to the Wayne Gretzky interview. Very proud. But he won't come on the show. So, like, he's refused. This was just revealed to us during the break. So, basically, we're going to have Craig Simpson on. He's going to play, like, you know, correspondence where you're with somebody, you're trying to freeze them out, and you go, like, Justin, tell Blake that I'll take us to break next one. That's what we'll do with our next guest. It's Craig Simpson. What's up, man? How you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you guys doing?
We're doing well. So, yeah, will you relay to Chris that we know that he's refused to do the show while Justin's on, and we're not happy with it. We're not.
But you're not happy with it. You're going to call him out, are you?
Yeah, okay. That's right. We're calling him out. This seems like a good play by me, is to call out like a legendary broadcaster. I'm sure this will work in my favor. This is going to be great.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, well, I'm sure he's I know he's extremely proud, and so I'm glad you settled for me. Thank you.
Well, it's Simmer. It's garbage, though. I mean, this guy won't retire until him and I are in a position where we can work together. So his assertion that he has to, that he wouldn't come up, like, it just doesn't make sense. Like, I think he's doing it for my benefit because I just refuse. But knowing him, it's a lie.
We need it. The next 3 weeks, it's got to happen.
While we're on the topic of him, though. While we're on the topic of him, Simmer, I mean, what sort of tax does he have to pay or fine? We were talking about fines for JD because he will not mute his hangouts here as we do our radio show from home. What sort of fine does he have to pay for going 100 goals off while doing the OV math for him chasing down Gretzky? I mean, that's got to be a considerable fine that he's got to pay.
Yeah, you know what? He goes right away. He goes, "Oh, I think I got something wrong on that one." I go, "Well, you know what? He's got a pass too. You talk about a schedule that you know, is one hard to get through. The fact that not only did he do the Olympics here, he jumped on a couple of our games too in the middle of it. I just said to him, "Your brain needs a little bit of a reset and a little time to settle down." So, as you know, live television, well, lots of things happen. I tell you the one thing that I will enjoy on Monday when the Leafs are in Columbus, we're finally traveling again. So that's been quite an experiment of sitting doing a game, you know, in Washington, and I'm sitting in, you know, either the Rogers Center in the baseball stadium or out at OMP. So it'll be nice to be on the road again.
Okay, but there's tons of us things that we want to get into with the Leafs, but that actually is a pretty interesting point of fascination. First of all, and I mean this sincerely, that's an incredible job by you guys doing that work. Because to not be there, to not only, you know, not have a feel for the arena, or to be there and to see the play and be relying on replays and reviews, it's just, there are certain things that I would guess that a casual viewer would miss in doing these things, but I actually think it's an incredible job by you guys that it wasn't noticeable often, right? Like, that it was so infrequent where you would go, hey, this is being played off of a monitor in these spots. But I think that if I would ask one thing, it's like, what is the biggest difference when you are calling a game that way that you notice that you just can't wait for with the travel? I'm sure there's stuff on the road you enjoy, but from the actual in-game standpoint, what is it that's the biggest swing for you?
Well, first and foremost, with fans in the stands, I mean, we've done games in the building where there is no energy, there is no emotion, there's, you know, no atmosphere. Oof. But you're sitting basically, you know, in a room with nobody around you, and it's hard to have that same kind of life and energy that a game brings you. I mean, the greatest thing about, as you know from your dad, calling like the golden goal, which was 12 years ago yesterday, is the energy in the building. I mean, it just brings you out of your seat. It brings you energy into your call. It makes you razor sharp about what you have to be on top of. So you have to fight and make it, that is all sort of a fake thing that you have to try to drive yourself up to bring your energy. But from an analyst standpoint, not being able to, I don't look at the puck all that much. You're looking at where the next guy's coming, who's changing, who's coming off the bench, and is he getting lost there? The one thing that we do have, you know, we have what you're watching up on program, but we do have the game play-by-play camera, which, you know, always kind of has the middle of the ice. So you do get a little bit of a better sense of at least who's coming into the play. But that's the thing to me is, you know, there's stretches. You can't even tell if the goalie's gone to the bench for the extra attacker because you got to wait until an extra body comes into the frame. So there's a lot not to like about it. But like everything during this strange 2 years that we've had of broadcasting in empty buildings, broadcasting from remotes, you know, the people who have had to do the job have done an amazing piece of work, from our technicians, from our tape people. You know, it's not been an easy task for everyone.
Yeah. Again, I think that you guys did a really good job of us not noticing, but the odd time making it noticeable so that they do send you back on the road, right? Like, you couldn't do it flawlessly.
Yeah,
otherwise,
you know,
you'd be stuck in OMP for the rest of your career. They'd be like, sorry.
You know how the game works. The game, yeah. You can't make it too good. If there was absolutely no difference, you know what the decision would be made. You're darn right about that one, for sure.
Right. The amount of, Bills, they would say you and Chris Cuthbert staying at the Ritz, you know, just that alone, they would have been so thrilled to get that off the books. That would be great for them. So we noticed that he listened to the show yesterday because you guys referenced the Wayne Gretzky interview that we did yesterday. We talked to Wayne. He mentioned going through a slump in his career. We were shocked to learn that he actually went 9 games without a goal once. That actually happened. We have it on record. He acknowledged it. But he mentioned that oftentimes when you are in a slump, you can try and press and try and essentially like get all those goals back that you're supposed to have over that stretch in one night. And for him, it was about simplify, simplify, simplify. And I wonder what you saw from John Tavares last night, if there was just a little bit of simplification to his game, or you saw a guy who didn't score a goal but maybe looked a little bit more like himself.
Yeah, I think a little bit more like himself. Without question, over the last previous 2 games, I listened to him on 2 separate occasions, and one was acknowledging some frustration that he was showing on the ice, and I think Wayne would say the same thing. If you're captain, if you're Wayne Gretzky, and you know you're showing that you're slapping your stick and you're frustrated, that's an unsettling feeling for your teammates. You know, this is a guy who's done everything, and for Tavares, you get a sense, you know, you're the captain, you're an influencer in your room, you're a guy that people look up to, and what's the pulse of the team? And if all of a sudden you're slapping your stick and getting frustrated, showing that frustration, I think I like the fact that he acknowledged that he had to stop that because it was a wasteful piece of energy. And then coming into the last game, he again identified and said, listen, I just got to try to do the little things to make a difference in a game. And that's what Chris mentioned at the end of it. With that kind of play, a couple of big face-offs, which he always has. He didn't have a spectacular night in the face-off circle, but he won little battles behind the net that created 2 goals. And, you know, you win a tight game, and your captain is a guy who, if he doesn't score, he was a direct influence on 2 of those goals. And that's the little things that I know Wayne was talking about, where if that's a simplifying your game, it's more just get your work ethic up to a high level, battle for loose pucks every chance you get, and try to win something that will create something for someone else if you're not the one who's going to be scoring. And, you know, mission accomplished. And he doesn't come out of that game feeling any better about his goal scoring. He still hasn't scored in 13, but he comes out of it going, hey, I did what I could to help our team win. And ultimately, that's when you're not putting the puck in the net, that's what you have to try to do.
Is it too hot takey to bring up that the play or one of the shifts before he ends up creating that pass to Hall and then the game-winning goal, Tom Wilson dumps him behind the net, like throws him down, and only one of his teammates, William Nylander, skates within 20 feet of him, and he kind of does a little flyby check-in, looks in, and then he goes to the bench. Tavares responds with a really, really energetic couple of shifts, like probably, I don't know, what looked to be some of his more engaged shifts of the game. But did that... Yep. Did that say something to you? Like, did that bother you at all? Did that stick out? Do you think that that had any impact on the rest of John's game? Like, it just – it was pretty shocking. I know no one's going to go out there and just, you know, beat the crap out of Tom Wilson. What are you supposed to do? But I can I at least get a guy that fakes like he cares about Tavares, the captain, on the ice for, like, a split second?
You know what? It's always – I mean, I guess you're always watching a game differently when you're a fan watching it or a bystander than when you're doing it. And, you know, there are things in a game that stick out and you go, oh, that was bad. You gotta come in and help someone there. Honestly, in a tight game, a tie game like that, and I think there are moments where a big hit, you saw Hathaway with about three or four hits, and that created a sequence where I thought, you know, you don't always have to jump in there and fight. I thought it got the energy, as you were just saying, and got the energy back in the Leafs of saying, okay, we got to play a little harder right now. They're running around. I don't remember, anyways, from a Tavares standpoint, any feeling as I was watching that, oh, God, like nobody's standing up for him. I personally, it's the old saying, you got to hit or be hit to get you into a game. And there are times in a game where you get clocked and you're like, oh, okay, and bring the game on. And it can drive you up. And I do think that those kind of – that sequence in the game where it did get physical, and it was Wilson a couple times, it was Hathaway about three or four hits. Look at Justin Hall. He took about three big hits to make a play to clear the zone. That can energize you and get you in the game. And I just go back to the battles that Tavares won in those critical times later. Hey, if getting run at certain time gets your energy to a level that you do that, I'm okay with that. I didn't feel at all that it was a situation that somebody should have been in there and trying to do something at that time.
Simmer, I know you haven't had the vantage point that you'd prefer over the last couple games, but we've seen some pretty productive returns from Justin Hall playing with TJ Brody. What do you make of that partnership? What it might mean for Justin Hall's game? Maybe what it might mean for the deadline strategy for the Maple Leafs here, but more importantly, how TJ Brody might be able to help Hall rediscover his game after what's been a very difficult season to this point.
Yeah, and I think there's no question that Brody is just, you know, an equalizer. He settles you down. I think I mentioned not so much last night, but the game in Detroit, I didn't notice Morgan Rielly jumping up nearly as much, didn't notice him in the play as much when he was playing with Liljegren, because for him, he's looking over, go, I don't trust the read of this guy. You know, I haven't played with him enough. And when you've got Brody over there, I think for Morgan, it allowed him to just go all the time and know what he's got. And I think for Hall, you know, credit him. He had a tough stretch. He was -5 in three games. And then he's now all of a sudden on a four-game scoring streak, and he's +10 in his last six games. And so, you know, is it all about Brody? That's only happened for the last few. I just think that as a young player or as a player who, you know, you're trying to make that next step to being reliable every day, you've got to find a way to be consistent. And I just think playing with a guy like Brody allows you to just get predictable reads and have a good chemistry of, you know, you got an outlet. And maybe that calms you down as a defenseman to say, man, the game seems to slow down a little bit. And even as he said last night, he made a couple of really tough hitting plays under pressure, but he sucked it up and he did it and he made it and he got himself some confidence in his game. And then he makes an incredible play on the game winning goal like that. So I think he knew this was a time where he had to show that I can play in this league and I can be okay. I'm not sure though, guys, if it's the pairings the way they are ones that are going to survive when you get into a key stretch in the season or a playoff game. But I think it was a needed experiment to see what you got in the other guys as well.
Yeah, and that's okay, and especially right now, given that it is experimentation time. Of course, you'd love to get the one seed, but yeah, trying to figure out whether or not you can get more from a player before the deadline is pretty critical. When you referenced, hey, I'm not sure that you can get away with this in the playoffs, that reeks of the Rielly-Liljegren pairing to me, where I go, well, that's just something that I cannot envision ever being in a tight, you know, game like that with actual stakes. Feeling like if I had to watch that and they're in a D zone and it's a face off, I would probably just go, okay, call me in 45 seconds. I'll come back to the TV. I'm taking little breaks from the television because there's just no way I can watch this. Yeah, but do you think that there's diminishing returns with this? Like, you might get something from a Hall, but you might end up putting a little bit more tax on a guy like Riley. How do you find that balance of just shuffling the blue line and trying to get these pieces going with these next few weeks?
Well, I mean, that's the great challenge that every coach, you know, is presented with, isn't it? In terms of, you know, unless you've got four stud guys that you don't ever really have to worry about, and then you can platoon in, you know, your fifth, sixth D, that's a luxury not a lot of teams have without a lot of thought or, you know, tinkering. So I think ultimately I like the fact, even though, you know, Sheldon's saying, hey, we're going to just try the lefty and righty, and that's why we've kept them to where they are. Okay. But I agree with you. I don't see that kind of pairing working, going right through those critical games. But I think it's also an indication that there's no question there's got to be an ad of somebody at some point to try to, you know, Muzzin is a, okay, he's probably going to play come playoff time or even later in the season. Who knows? But you know there's going to be an injury. So bringing Muzzin back into the mix changes the dynamic quite a bit. But I think there's no question what this little tinkering does is say, okay, I think I know what we got. We know Sandin's he's a gamer. But there's going to be a series where maybe he has some trouble too. So maybe we will have to change it at times. So I think if nothing else, it's, this little stretch, especially without Muzzin, would say to Dubas, I've got to bring somebody else in here too to be an insurance policy.
So I guess I would probably only bring this up because the Leafs power play has been so hot and they were so broken last year. Like, to go from it actually kind of pairs well with the Jack Campbell thing, where it's more of a story given the highs and the lows than if you look at it in the totality of it. But the power play has hit a little bit of a drought. And yeah, normally I would ignore it, but are you seeing anything right now that is different? Are you seeing anything right now that, yeah, you're looking at and saying, oh, I don't really like this? Or is this just, hey, it's a blip, let's ignore it until it gets much, much greater?
No, you know, it's a stretch of games where, okay, you got six games you haven't scored. Prior to that in the three, though, you went 5-for-7. So I think I liked actually Sheldon's comment about it last night. You know, you got a team coming in to a stretch where they've gone at a 71% clip in a three-game stretch. If I'm a coach and I was an assistant coach that had to look at all the penalty kill and power play, and you're coming in, you're spending an awful lot more time about what are we going to do with this power play as a penalty killing unit than you do any other team, for sure. So I think part of it is when you're clipping along at the level that they have, you're getting a lot more of a dissecting, you know, view from your opponent's coaches, and a lot of time on the board, a lot of time on video for the penalty killing that you're going up against. So that's more than what is normally there. And so, you know, at times you can get through that without any problem. But I do think last night's the first night I would really say, yeah, they just didn't look as sharp. They didn't look as fluid. And I think that can be a combination of, you know, Tavares hasn't scored in 13. The other guys have been playing really well 5-on-5. I thought Morgan Riley was, as I was mentioning before, a little out of it in terms of not quite as fluid, not quite as up to speed. So, you know, you got to reevaluate and as the coaching staff look at it and see. But I don't think there's any question, and you see it all around the league, and this has happened with the Leafs before. And it's happened with the Edmonton Oilers, who were up there with the Leafs on their power play. Teams come in and they're saying, hey, we're not going to chase around like those other teams were. And I mentioned it last night. I thought Washington stayed tight when they needed to be, made sure those cross-seam passes weren't available. And then as soon as the puck goes, you're not over-pursuing. Because when that power play, much like the Leafs 5-on-5, when they get cycling with the puck and moving bodies and moving the puck quickly, you know, when you start chasing, it's one thing about being aggressive, but if you're not aggressive in unison and you're behind, then that's when the holes all open up. And I think Washington just said, we're not going to do that last night. And the Leafs power play unit didn't handle it all that well.
We had Steven Valiquette on in the last hour, and he was crushing some of the dreams of Leaf fans in the text line, saying pretty unequivocally that he doesn't believe that the Leafs have a legitimate starting goaltender. That may or may not be the case, but they have two options here moving forward and into the playoffs. With where Jack Campbell is right now and with the opportunity that seems to be in front of Peter Mrazek, how would you sort of approach this situation if you're Sheldon Keefe, and where are you leaning over the next couple of weeks to you know, make sure that you get the most out of this team performance-wise and results-wise, but also massaging what is a bit of a tricky situation?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about being in the coaching staff, that, you know, even us talking about it or even me covering it, you don't have a sense of, you know, okay, what does Steve Briere say to Sheldon about the mindset of Jack Campbell, or what do I think he needs? Do I think he needs a little time off, or do I think he needs to get in there even if it's not going well? You know, that's where those kind of conversations are really important, to get a sense of, you know, you can sit and listen to Jack sit up and answer questions and you know his personality, but you don't get a real sense of what you see every day. You know, there are times, and I'm sure Steve would have said, there are times, you know, even as a teammate, that you get into practice and you go, oh boy, our goalie's lost it. Like, 'cause I'm scoring every time in practice, where I don't really know if that's the case of, okay, is Jack really struggling at all levels, or is it just one that you get through a stretch, you get a lot of deflection goals and a lot of bad breaks, and now you've got to just sort of allow him to regroup. I don't think there's any question, though, what this dip for Campbell has done, and has really opened the door and opened the mindset for Sheldon Keefe, knowing I got to keep Mrazek in the mix, and I might even have to run with him for a little bit. So, you know, if Campbell had kept at the click he was going early, it would have been a challenge for Sheldon to say, well, I can't really put Mrazek in. He hasn't had much time. Well, now he's had some time. And I didn't think Mrazek was great early on last night either. He didn't, you know, settle me in saying, oh, yeah, he's got this. He's neat and tidy. But he did the last two games as he's come in. He's done what he had to do to get the win. But I think somebody asked me yesterday, you know, you think the Leafs are in for making a trade for a goaltender? You look at the reality of, A, what's out there, and B, from a cap perspective, and what the needs of this team are in the other positions. There's not a chance, in my opinion, that's going to happen. So I think the path for Sheldon is to keep Mrazek engaged, work with Beer with getting Campbell to a stage where, you know, get yourself righted, challenge yourself to be better, and there's going to be a stretch where maybe he gets two or three in a row to see if he can get on a roll again.
JD, you're muted, pal.
Craig Simpson, thank you for coming on with us this morning. I was so close to having a good non-mute segment. I blew it right at the end. Good.
Another fine. Another fine.
Safe travels.
All right, guys. Take care. Thanks for having me on.
Craig Simpson, former NHL forward, two-time Stanley Cup champion, and current Sportsnet analyst. I'm not hopeful about the idea that the Leafs are going to trade for a goaltender, nor should you really want them to, I think. Like, the better case scenario here is that both guys end up getting hot again. I guess, like, that's the upside, right, of having two streaky goalies if we play off Valaket, that there is a chance you could get both guys hot at once. It's just, I don't know. I'm trying to spin this in some way that makes it a little bit more hopeful.
Just one would be great.
Yeah. How many goals do you think Austin Matthews is scoring on those guys in practice right now? They're like, Craig Simpson's like, oh, when our goalie's in practice, I'm like, Austin Matthews.
No, they don't let him on the ice with them.
Yeah.
He's shooting on the E-Bug or the U of T goalie or whatever.
It looked like Peter Mrazek was guessing on that Tom Wilson shot, like down a little early. I got to cheat.
Yeah.
If you got to cheat for Tom Wilson, I imagine you're getting down early with Austin Matthews storming down a 2-on-1 uncontested.
So maybe not help coming in the form of goaltending. But where help is coming is in the form of fans back at Scotiabank Arena, and we want to send you. So good news, Leafs fans. Our Maple Leafs ticket giveaway contest is coming back. Starting tomorrow, we're giving you a chance to win Leafs tickets for every home game with our Hockey Code Words contest. All you have to do is download episodes of the Fan Morning Show and listen for the code word that will be provided in each episode. Then text that code word to 590-590, and you'll be entered for a chance to win tickets. First up will be this Saturday's game against the Vancouver Canucks, the best team, if you're a Leaf fan, to root against. B, Be sure to download tomorrow and Thursday's episodes of the Fan Morning Show for your chance to win. Once again, every show moving forward, giving away tickets to Leafs home games, but you got to download the podcast episodes and listen for the code word that's snuck in there somewhere. And unfortunately, I apologize, it'll be me reading the code words instead of Ailish this time. Less of a treat, less of a happy surprise. But you get free tickets out of it, maybe. So do we want to take a break? Yeah, let's take a break. Let's take some of your texts. So in addition to texting those code words to 590-590 when the contest starts tomorrow, you can send us your text right now, 590-590. We'll answer a few of them after the break. Maybe reset Raptors Nets tonight at 7:30 on Sportsnet 590. That's next on the Fan Morning Show.
Smart takes on the biggest stories in sports. The Fan Drive Time with Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Fan Morning Show. Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Blake Murphy, JD Bunkus, Justin Cuthbert. As I said before the break, our Leafs ticket contest giveaway is back starting tomorrow, but that means you have to subscribe, download the podcast episodes, The Fan Morning Show, wherever you get your podcast. Please rate, review, subscribe, all that good stuff. Keep sending JD your bet slips too. The Wake and Rake hit last night. It's been a good day. It's been a good start to the week. We were worried the vibes could be a little off without Ailish, but we're hanging in there so far. Maybe the vibes are off in the text line though. JD, what do you got for us?
I have a lot. And I'm surprised at how many people. Sorry, there's so many questions about about how many Malachi Flynn questions there are. But I am going to say this: I did get this Tiff and Kitchener. This would be good because again, for Ailish, which is she wrote in the spirit of Ailish, I shouted muted at my radio, ha ha ha, and consume Miss Vicky's chips for breakfast. Ketchup. My Tuesday question: should JD face repercussions for this muting fiasco today? From Tiff and Kitchener.
Unquestionably.
Yeah. The conviction in which you answer that, like, unquestionably. I don't really know what a fair penance is, though. Like, what am I supposed to do for this?
I don't know. I don't, well, the thing is, like, we could try to levy a punishment and, like, have, like, a mute jar or something like that, but I don't trust for a second that you'll pay up, so.
Yeah.
There's no recourse.
Sir, how hurtful of you. How hurtful of you. Like, you know me. I'm Mr. Throws the Credit Card Out.
I don't know. I have no recent example of this, JT.
I just bought you beers and a snack like 2 days ago.
It's
like, hurtful, hurtful, hurtful. I will not be called cheap, not on this show. That hurts so much. There's a lot of talk.
It's not cheap. It's more of like the real life equivalent of my excuse making for the Wake and Rake. There will be some context where no. I won the mute jar back somehow because I muted one time. Yeah. Like we won't even know. You'll be like Oscars grinding the mute button where it's like double or nothing.
Oscars grinding. I want to get into some of this Freddie Anderson stuff because there's a lot of people who are like pushing back on the Freddie thing and the text line. There's a lot of like I'm kind of trying to basically rip them all together or push them all together, but it's like, hey, all these different things about Freddie Anderson and they had to let Freddie Anderson go and blah 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 blah. So I still actually agree with that Freddie's time in Toronto had reached a logical conclusion. He played through his injury. He was clearly pretty upset. There are reports, depending on who you ask, that Anderson was upset with the way he was being handled as far back as the Columbus season, in terms of the deployment and the way that he was being handled and the way that he was being treated and blah, 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 blah. But by the logic of they had to move off of Freddie Anderson, it's weird that we don't bring up how it's really in direct defiance of Kyle Dubas' whole philosophy of like, you just run it back with the best talent, right? How this doesn't get brought up more often is it's pretty damn clear at this point. I think even if you are the biggest believer that quote unquote Freddie is not clutch or whatever other thing that you want to point to that you say he is, that he's obviously a better goaltender than Mrazek or Jack Campbell. Like that's just like, I don't even know where you would begin with the debate that those guys are even close to on his level given his NHL track record and his career. And so I am curious why you guys think we don't ever bring that up in reference to Kyle Dubas, again, given that it is a core foundational piece of his philosophy.
I think the answer is probably that philosophy is not completely universal. Zach Hyman left as well. It was 5 years of Freddie
but
here.
But Zach Hyman got paid through the nose, sure, whereas Freddie sure, got no,
that's,
less than
that's
Mrazek.
A good distinction. That's an important distinction. And look, Freddie was $8.95 last year. I actually think the playoff stuff has been a little overstated with him anyway, where like his playoff save percentage over the life of his Leafs tenure was .916. It's not, he had one bad playoffs, and it's not really like he, it was every year that was the issue or anything like that. So yeah, statistically, I mean, look, career sample wise, he's similar to Campbell, but he has a much larger sample and a much longer track record of consistency, where he was until last year, he was Mr. Consistency. His save percentage was the exact same every year. He was like the case that save percentage stabilizes at 60 games played. It's a little bit of an odd one, and it kind of leaves you to operate in the kind of intangible of like the relationship. You know, sometimes they end, and that's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
Anderson being a thousand more than Peter Mrazek. You losing me, guys?
For a second,
we were for a second.
Back.
You're good though.
You're back.
Okay, it seems I'm back. You said logical conclusion. I think both sides felt that. And I feel like the Leafs bought into Jack Campbell and jury out, maybe justifiably so, but I think they were ready to move on from Freddie Anderson. Moving on from past postseason failure, not showing up in the big moments. I just think it hit the end of them with you. I mean, I think Freddie Anderson was...
Cuthbert, you got to reconnect. You're going robot again. You're going robot again. We're gonna cut you off and just go back to robot. I think that Justin's right, that it was a logical conclusion on both ends, and that it was a good time to move off. And it's a really hard thing to over criticize. The only thing that I would, and it gets back to what Valiquette said, is some guys don't do well in a split. Some guys want to be the guy. And by my estimation, when you're looking at things, Freddie Anderson, when he looked at Carolina, they said, hey, yeah, we're going to give you a 2-year deal. It's not going to be the most money in the world, but you're the guy. And that seems pretty clearly important to Freddie Anderson. Again, if you look back at the reports with Fred, the time that he seemingly got the most upset was when they traded for Jack. When they went out and got him in the first place, that was the time where he said, I don't want to give up my net more. I want to play. The guy likes to play. I did all these shows on Good Show about bringing in guys like Ed Belfour and asking him, what is the obligation of a coach to protect you from yourself for goalies like that? Because there are a lot of dudes who just want to play. And now we have different stuff with sports sciences, and we have different things in terms of what the wear and tear is on a goaltender, the travel, everything, that you can try to optimize this position, and balancing those two things is a tough one. So yeah, I can't really criticize the Leafs too much for Freddie Anderson. I just mostly have fun with having the discussion, because it is funny how quickly it turned on its head, and how much flack I took for defending Freddie Anderson the way that I used to defend Freddie Anderson.
That's your guy.
Yeah. Where was this one? Now I know Ailish's struggle of the text line always moving around. Oh yeah, Masvidal. The Masvidal-Colby fight. Someone asked us who we've got. Blake, who do you got?
I'm going to go Masvidal in that one. I know Saga. That... Pardon me?
It's Jordan and Saga who asked this question, your rival.
Jordan and Saga. Trying to get out of my bad books with a question that doesn't throw shade this time, eh? Yeah. Okay, we see you. I'll probably play the underdog side of this. He's plus 260 outright. I mean, honestly, with a main event with two guys that love to swing it like this, I'll probably play the prop game once they come up. Right now, the under 4.5 rounds is plus 120 as well. So I'd imagine you're going to get some juicy props if you want to play the round specific game. Look, Colby's a minus 350 favorite for a reason, but a fight like this, especially with these personalities, the great interview Masvidal gave us last week, I'm going to ride Masvidal plus 260 and probably play some knockout props.
So I hate how... Colby's just in a different part of his career than Jorge.
Yeah.
But you know me. You know what I'm going to do. That just means that I'm going to bet a Jorge Masvidal knockout at a big number. That's all it's going to be. And
if we could pay a little tribute here, it's just $5. Sprinkle to your gut or whatever it is she says.
Yeah, it's literally just the only way for me to play this. I don't need to bet every single fight as a sharp. I actually view it as, hey, there are certain people that I blind bet on. I've said Derek Lewis is one of them. I'm never betting against Derek Lewis. I don't want to watch a fight where I'm betting against him. That's no fun for me, even if I do think he's going to lose. And I thought the last fight that there was really good value against him, right? He was weirdly favored, and the good thing about Derek Lewis is he's normally an underdog, and so you should bet him as a dog because he does have that literal puncher's chance. But yeah, I'm going to bet the puncher's chance on Masvidal in this one because as much as I do think Colby is the fighter who is in his prime right now, has the more clear path to victory, blah, 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 it's a little too steep of a line. That's a little that's what I'm saying, is a guy who was handling himself pretty well in the Usman fight last time around and got his clock cleaned, obviously. But, you know, I just think that he's done as good of a job as anybody against Kamaru.
Also, maybe a little bit of a concern with Colby, and maybe not a concern. This is probably why the line is at the line for the over-under on rounds is leaning toward over 4.5. It's leaning towards a distance. But Colby's last 6 wins, 5 of them were by decision, and one of them was headed to decision until Tyrone Woodley got that rib injury. So
yeah,
there is a little bit of, like, I Masvidal, obviously your play here, especially if you want to play both sides or just have fun in the prop game, is if it goes the distance, you really like Colby. But yeah, you know, so maybe there's an in-fight betting play there, but I don't know. I don't know that it's been a minute since Colby showed off the knockout and punching power. Like August 2016 is where you have to go back to for something like that. So when you're talking about plus 260 odds and one guy has a clear knockout advantage if things break right, I like that.
Yeah, I think you could play that fight two ways. The Colby decision or the Masvidal knockout. I mean, Colby, though, like, I'm going to be alone on this one. I don't think I would touch Masvidal just because Colby is Usman without power. Like, he is on the same level. He's just less, he just carries less power. And I think he could do the same things that Usman did, especially in that first fight, just do it without probably that knockout possibility. And that's why it's probably safe to play him on a decision. It's probably safe to play him in a parlays if you really wanted to, despite him being so chalky.
Yeah, I think the parlay piece is too rich for me. I think that's too sketchy. If, like, you know, that, because here's the other part of it. That's the last leg of a parlay if you're playing it. And then all of a sudden you're losing your parlay at 1 o'clock in the morning on a Masvidal knockout where everyone's having a blast and so fun because they've knocked out the villain and you're sitting there with, like, you know, your,
well, that's,
you know,
the knockout hedge, right? That's, you got your parlay.
Yeah, or if it's
there,
big enough, you could hedge out.
And then you hedge out, yeah. The other thing I'm watching for in this card, and it hasn't been locked in yet, but our guy Ariel Helwani was kind of banging this drum yesterday on his show. Islam Makhachev has stepped up to offer to fight Rafael Dos Anjos. Makhachev just fought on Saturday. He's ready to go. He wasn't touched in that fight. Obviously, that was a fight where he was a minus 1,000 favorite because it was a last-minute fill-in. Give me that. I would be so curious what the line is like for a guy fighting back-to-back Saturdays. And I love Makhachev. I think he's a real player in that division. So if we get that again, him and Dos Anjos, that would really spice up that card to me. It's not a bad card by any means. We got Edson Barbosa as an underdog in the co-main, and you've got, you know, the draw to watch Greg Hardy get knocked out, which is always fun. Kevin Holland on the card. So you add a last minute Makhachev Dos Anjos, and this is shaping up to be a really nice Saturday.
-1,000 favorite, obviously. So you couldn't, like, really, really bet on it. But that type of fighter in all of sports betting is the best thing to gamble on, when it's just a suffocating wrestler and you can enjoy 15 minutes of a guy smothering someone else because you know there is no chance you are losing that bet. It's just like that is, there's not even like the Hail Mary chance. It's just 15 minutes or 25 minutes of another guy smothering another, and you can just revel in it. I love betting on smothering wrestlers in the UFC.
Yeah, it was good to be on. It's unfortunate how quickly the Hamzat train basically ended, but I loved that at the beginning of his career, where it was like, hey, he's fighting a nobody who's stepping in here. He's going to dominate him in a way that you've never seen before. Love
Bilal Muhammad's another one that you could just ride the decision victory over and over again, basically.
So I've got this one. I like this one because it's a philosophical question for all of us. So it's from Adam in Shelburne. He says, "Morning, guys. With the Leafs using the LTIR space for Muzzin, This is assuming that it does. It opens up the possibility for just under $6 million in cap space. I don't know if that's true. Blake will basically fact check that. Do you think the Leafs should use it for just one player, either a D or a forward, or should they use it on two lower cost players? So I'm going to just kind of pivot this question. Like, what do you think is the better route here? That if you were given the opportunity, do you try to add two different things and just like really go all in asset wise? Or do you try to load up and say, like, we talked about Chychrun earlier, how much that's going to cost you. That's one area of need. That's one big player. That's a big splash. That's control. That's a whole bunch of things at once, but only at one position. I'll start with you, Justin.
Well, in a perfect world, I think you find players with term that you can minimize that term on. Like, I really do think the valuable thing potentially about Chychrun is the possibility of trimming down a $4.6 million salary. But if it is one move, one thing, salaries stay the same, one trade, that's what you got, I'd like an impact performer on the back end. Because again, I can't spin zone, hey, Tavares needs help, or anyone else in that forward unit needs help. It's clear what needs to be fixed, what needs support, and that is the defense core, the top four in particular. I'd like two defensemen. I'd like a little bit of extra to make sure that you have the depth, because an injury is going to happen. But a real, legitimate impact defender that can help carry another player on this roster is the, if there is one fix, that's the one fix. But again, I think you can be more ambitious than that with Muzzin potentially going on LTIR, and with teams potentially like Arizona or others that are uninterested in being that competitive, willing to retain a little bit of salary. That's when you can really fix problems now and into the future.
I'd agree that, like, I'm shooting for one high-end defense, but obviously the answer to this is, like, depends what the market allows and stuff like that. But
Change your question. The question is a question. Justin already cheated. Now you're cheating too. Everybody's cheating on the question.
I'm not cheating. I would like one high-end defenseman. Yeah. And part of the reason for that is, like, I do think you have an internal solution to the second line thing that, even if it's not your favorite solution, like, Kasha has looked fine to good on that line. And the third line iteration, I know Kasha and Kamp have the magic together, but that Kamp Engvall Mikheyev iteration of the third line has been really good too. So, like something like 79 or 76% shot share when they're together. So you have an internal solution if you need. You put Kasha on that line. Tavares and Nylander are going to play better by, like, most likely. And Kasha's a decent fit there. So you kind of have a way to resolve that if you need. What you don't have a way to resolve is the fact that even if Muzzin is healthy, you've got four defensemen that you trust. And in terms of will they use the LTIR, the Kyle Clifford thing yesterday, that suggests to me they are, like they opted not to send him down before his waiver cutoff. They've now eaten up most of the accrued cap space that they could have had. So it certainly seems like they're operating as if the LTIR is going to be a thing.
So I'm with you guys. If you can end up with one big splashy top four defenseman, that's what you do. It's just, I don't know. Normally I'm all about depth, and I think that's probably the way they end up going here, because that big splashy acquisition is tougher to do. And so if you can't do that, clearly the pivot is, well, let's add a couple bullets in the chamber, right? Let's add a couple of pieces. Let's insulate for playoffs, for injury, for whatever. But I really just, I'm with Cuthbert on this. That one big splashy move, I really hope it's not for a forward. Like, if it is for a forward, then it has to be both. Then you have to do two things. Because I just don't think that getting JT Miller changes the ceiling of this team in some kind of a significant, meaningful way. I think it's good for you, obviously, but do you really feel that differently about this team if he's on the roster?
Not particularly. And like, look, you winning games 5-3 is the same as winning games 3-1, like in the big picture. But there are more diminishing returns, I think, when you already have capable forward depth and you already have 9-10 guys. Like, you could, I mean, they trust Kerfoot at a level that's...
He's not coming cheap.
Exactly. And yeah. So, I don't know. I would lean pretty heavily defensively. I have not had a lot of issues with envisioning this team being able to score. And I think I think the third line, whichever combination of those five guys, you can include Kerfoot in there and the numbers still hold up, you've got that figured out. You obviously have a first line that you know is set, and there's no option but to keep, like, at this point, if your first and third line are set, Tavares and Nylander are probably staying together, and you're just trying to work on that. So, yeah. I don't think the forward stuff moves. Like, there is this isn't baseball necessarily, where there's actually the opposite of diminishing returns to offense because it raises everyone. I do think there's a little bit asset-wise of, okay, if you add another forward and your depth kind of goes down and those guys are playing fewer minutes, there is a diminishing returns there. Whereas on defense, this is a big needle mover. If the type of guy we're talking about would be a big needle mover.
It shouldn't be prioritized, but if this matters, Tavares getting dumped by Tom Wilson, there would be a response if JT Miller was on the ice, and for guarantee you, JT Miller, in addition to be able to potentially offer that, is a far more talented offensive player than Alexander Kerfoot. I mean, that line, while it would still not measure up to what Matthews and Marner and Bunting are doing, would be really, really complete. Like, have every potential dimension that you could ask for in a top six unit. And again, that's the one that should be getting mismatches down the stretch and into the postseason. But if you are doing that to ignore the obvious problems on the back end, I don't really know what to help or to tell you.
I think it's more if there isn't something on the back end. You know, I think it's clearly like, you go and do that move if there's nothing available to you on the blue line of any consequence, and you say, well, is it better to roll the dice and gamble on adding this forward and making our team better and hoping for you to unlock that? Well, we're supposed to have two first lines thing. We clearly have one. Maybe we get the second. Maybe this is worth it. My only sort of pushback for the Miller thing is, like, I like JT Miller. I remember when Canucks fans actually hated that they acquired him and thought, no, this is actually really good for you. Like, this guy is going to be awesome for your team. And then, of course, he has the first season where he's beloved and then whatever. But I'd love JT Miller. The issue is not, like, do I like him on the team? Do I like what he'd bring to that line? It's just like Kyle Dubas just said that they have limited bullets in the chamber, right, when it comes to trades. And for a team that's really capped out and that is going to have some difficulties over the next couple of seasons, like, yeah, okay, Jack Campbell might not be the Leafs starting goaltender of the future, but you're going to have to find somebody who can be that if he isn't. And it's going to cost you more than whatever Jack's making right now. Like, what is it, 1.25, 1.5, somewhere in that range? Like, they get the Kessel money off the books, but they're going to lose Mikheyev. Like, there's just stuff on this roster that they're going to have to do in seasons moving forward. And so having, like, low-cost, controllable guys that can come into your lineup is super critical for a team that's pushing up against the cap. And having those draft picks and losing them year over year over year, like, that stuff comes back to haunt you a little bit. So if you're just saying, yay, we're dumping all this, like, this isn't football with the Los Angeles Rams. So I don't know. It's just, it's tough given what they have in the asset chamber more than anything else. If they were loaded up and they had a bunch of, like, a deep farm system and a whole bunch of picks, I'd be like, yeah, go get JT Miller, go get whatever. But it's just that they don't.
And it's not just bringing in JT Miller's salary. You probably have to spend another bullet to get Alex Kerfoot out. I mean, I think Vancouver might be interested. He is a local kid.
I think he's, like, a neutral asset.
Talent, he's like a neutral asset. You probably have to at least acknowledge that it's going to be a higher price if you're going to dump a salary or an asset that you don't want on someone else.
Yeah. See, that's part of the upside for me, though, is that it's like, okay, you get off the last year of the Kerfoot deal. We got to go. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for all the texts. Thanks for all the DMs. We'll chat then. It's the Fan Morning Show. Blake Murphy, Justin Cuthbert, and JD Bunkus. Talk then.